It's our draft and auction recap episode. We'll recap our 2024 draft season, not just by evaluating our own rosters, but also by giving you strategy, tactics, and in-depth discussions of the various league formats. Justin Mason of the Sleeper and the Bust podcast joins us on this strategy-filled episode of Beat the Shift next. And welcome to another episode of the Beat the Shift podcast. I am your host, Ariel Cohen, and with me as always, Ruven Guy. What's going on, Ruven?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Just got through Tout Wars weekend. Well, we had a show in between about the injury episode. That was really great where we ran through everything. Great job on that. A lot of compliments in the show, Ruven.
Thanks. It was a lot of work putting together, and I hope everyone enjoyed it and make it useful for their own drafts.
Absolutely. So we thought today, since we got through pretty much all of the industry expert drafts and auctions, that we'd sort of go through a recap of the strategy and differences between league formats. I think that's going to help you, the listener, out quite a bit. And to join us, coming back on the show once again this year, Justin Mason. What's going on, Justin?
Hey, it's great to be back. I mean, don't usually get to do multiple episodes in a draft season for you guys, so it's nice to be back for a second one.
Absolutely. So Justin was in a bunch of auctions with me and Ruven this draft season, I believe three of them. So we figured let's just, you know, since we're all in it, let's just talk about our experiences in them and strategize together. So let's actually start in draft season with a draft. I mean, TGFBI is something that Justin created himself, so nobody better to talk about it. Justin, why don't you first just explain to everybody what is TGFBI?
So TGFBI stands for the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational. It is the largest fantasy baseball industry league in the fantasy realm, or in the fantasy baseball realm. This year, 28 leagues, so 420 participants. Broke it up into 15-team leagues with an overall. So it's NFBC style, so no trading. There is an overall, which everybody's competing for. And it's just a really fun way to kind of bring the industry together and also raise some money for charity, which is always great.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we got 400-plus industry guys drafting together. We can really learn some good tendencies from the collective. So the number one question we have for you is one thing that TGFBI does is it runs KDS, Kentucky Derby-style draft preferences. So instead of randomizing the order of where you're drafting, you actually get to choose where you want to place. Now, obviously, we randomize who gets to pick first. Maybe you picked first, maybe somebody else did. But you get a preference. You can pick in the middle, the end, the front, whatever. What was your draft preferences and why?
So my draft preference this year, or at least for TGFBI, was to have one be my first pick because this was pre-injury to Ronald Acuna, and then kind of be somewhere in the middle because I felt like coming into those drafts, Acuna was the clear number one, and then there was about seven or eight guys that you could really consider as, you know, somewhere between two and eight, two and nine. So to me, like, I kind of wanted an earlier pick in the second round. So I just decided, hey, if I don't get number one, then I want to be somewhere in the middle. I'm less susceptible to runs that way as well. So for me, I chose nine as my kind of second choice, and that's what I ended up with.
Yeah. I mean, Ruven, you and I think pretty much did the same thing. Number one, obviously a given to get Acuna, and we like drafting in the middle, right?
Yes, 100%. I think I put down one, and then I put down five, six, seven, because two, three, four, I wasn't thrilled with those guys. I'm not that I wouldn't want them on my team. I just thought there was more value when you get to the middle because you get more value coming back around.
Yeah, I like picking in the middle because you can extract value. You don't have to wait 30 picks to get your guy, so you don't have to reach as many picks to get your guy. And when you do that over the course of a draft, you pick up a dollar here, $2 here, and it really helps with the overall value. We've explained this before on previous shows, but good that you confirmed it. Okay, so we're not going to go through everything and talk about, well, I got this player and I love this player, but let's talk about some strategy and all that. So I'm going to name a couple of items that you could strategize about, and maybe everyone will go around the room and talk about one or two items that they addressed. So just general strategy, maybe you want to talk about what you did in your first four rounds, how you address saves, how you address catchers, maybe speed, maybe a strikeouts, or, you know, maybe everyone go around the room and address that. So, Justin, why don't you start off and talk about some things that you really looked to strategize about and how you executed it in THFBI.
So typically what I want to leave my first kind of few rounds with, my first four or five rounds, is I want to leave with at least one elite starting pitcher. I'd like to leave with one elite closer, and then I want to just load up on balanced offense, right? So... and in my draft, what I did was I started Freddie Freeman, then I went Francisco Lindor, took Gallen in the second round, and then Emmanuel Clase in the fourth. So, which was kind of my strategy playing out fairly well. I got two offensive guys at the top of the draft that both contribute a ton of stats in every category, and then I got an elite starter and an elite closer. So I felt pretty good about my strategy coming in and then executing it, at least through the first four or five rounds.
All right. So one thing I noticed in your team is you started off with Freddie Freeman from the nine spot. Now, you had a couple of options. You could have chosen Freeman. You could have chosen Turner. You could have chosen Soto or Judge. What made you pick Freddie Freeman above anybody else?
Well, I really wanted Tatis, and Tatis went the pick right before me. But I feel like Freddie Freeman is probably a top five guy and just gets discounted because he's a first baseman and it's easy to find first base late. But I mean, when you're batting on top of that order with guys like Mookie Betts and Shohei Ohtani, the Dodgers team is just going to score a ton of runs. And I feel like runs scored is a pretty... underrated category, at least on the offensive side of fantasy. I think people don't put enough weight into that one. So being able to get a guy that is going to give me a good batting average, he's going to hit 300, he's going to score a ton of runs, get a ton of RBIs, hit for power, and steal some bases, I felt like was a really, really good way to start.
And Ruven, you felt the same way because out of the seven spot, you also started with Freddie Freeman.
Yeah, for all the reasons that Justin just mentioned. I mean, I could have gone Soto. I could have gone Judge. Tatis went 11th in my league. But I just liked Freddie Freeman. He's been so steady. There's value for first basemans later on, but I just like having Freddie Freeman on my team, especially because he also steals bases. He's got the high average, he's got the power, he steals some bases from a first baseman, which is very rare, and I was able to complement the rest of the team in the first three rounds. I had Freddie Freeman, I had Michael Harris, I liked that compliment right there. Bo Bichette was my third round pick, so right there already I have three top hitters. I have stolen bases, but they're spread out. It's not one person, it's a spread out, and then I decided to go for a pitcher, and that's when I went for Framber Valdez. And Justin, you mentioned about getting a closer in the first four rounds. I don't love the values up there, and I mean, you know, hindsight, a lot of those guys are already getting injured, but I went with Evan Phillips in the sixth round. I waited a little bit. I wanted to wait for a sweet spot. I don't like getting a top closer if I don't have to, because I don't want to have to overpay for him. So Evan Phillips, I did have to reach a little bit in the sixth round, but that's because in my draft, they started actually drafting closers, and I thought I was going to be shut out closers completely.
Evan Phillips currently leads the league in saves with one. I picked Juan Soto. I got the 12th pick in the draft, and I pretty much got whoever was left to me. All those guys that you mentioned, Turner and Judge and everybody, they all went already. The choice for me was Ohtani or maybe a Jose Ramirez or Garrett Cole. Thank goodness I didn't choose Cole there. I took Juan Soto. I thought that was easily the top player available. For me, I really focused on category balance. I wanted to make sure that I had enough speed. And, you know, because in an auction, you can get someone whenever you want, or you have the ability to get, you don't have to wait picks. You're involved in every single bidding process. You can't do that in a draft. So round three, Randy Arozarena was available. And I said, okay, I'm going to start off with an outfielder with some speed. Great. I chose speed in a lot of other places. In round nine, I could have taken Anthony Santander, but I took Lane Thomas instead. Similar value, but Thomas, a little bit more edge on the steals. And then when it came around, I could have still taken Santander, but I chose Jarren Duran. So I wanted to really bank the speed before it went late. I made sure I had enough average. I saw that Alec Bohm was available in the 12th round. Shored that up. I started with a lot of power. I got Juan Soto and Austin Riley early. So I sort of addressed categories as they came up. You can't, in a draft, you can't take care of everything. Like, for example, catchers, I didn't really get a premium catcher. I got Kybert Ruiz, you know, a mid number one level catcher. And then I waited to the 24th round, and luckily Jake Rogers was available for me in the 24th round. At that point, I said, okay, he's valuable here, and so take it. So, you know, it really depends on what you have given to you, but you do need to you will have to let go of something. You can't address every single need. Any other quick points that anybody wants to make about the drafts?
Yeah, Justin, I actually saw that you took your catchers late. You don't like taking the top catchers? You prefer to stay away from them, or are you just waiting for value on those?
Yeah, I don't tend to like that. I tend to like to grab my catchers a little bit earlier. But as you'll see in a few of these industry drafts, I felt like catchers were going off the board a little bit earlier than I would have liked to take them. So I don't mind waiting, especially when you get a guy like I got Garver in the 12th round, and then Alejandro Kirk I got in the 20th round. The Kirk one looks a lot better now with Danny Jansen out for quite a while with a broken wrist. But I just felt like the guys that I was targeting were going a little bit too high, and I didn't want to kind of reach on a guy that I wasn't truly enthused about, because there are a lot more late options than there have been in other years. So I don't mind going with the cheaper catchers. I do prefer to grab the earlier ones because you get more plate appearances.
Yeah, I have another question for you about your draft. You got Nico Hoerner in the 5th round, and I've noticed that he's particularly valuable to get in draft because he's a guy that really plugs the batting average, the steals, and the runs, and it's easier to find somebody cheaper later that can plug in some homers and RBIs at a discount. But to get those trifecta, it's just a great player that satisfies everything. So even if you have to reach value-wise a little bit for him, he's still worth it because it's a unique profile and it helps building teams. Do you agree with that? And is that why you got Hoerner?
Yeah, absolutely. I know there's been a lot of pushback on Hoerner this year as a guy that shouldn't be going as high as he is, but I honestly think he's undervalued in a lot of drafts. I mean, he's going to steal a ton of bases. He's going to put up a really good batting average. He has elite bat-to-ball skills, which is something I love in a guy because it gives you the opportunity to get lucky, right? And a lot of people are going to go, well, he got lucky in the batting average. Well, when you make as much contact as Nico Hoerner does, he's going to give himself the opportunity to get lucky and get on base at a pretty high clip. He's going to lead off in Chicago, which is still a really, really good offense. And like you said, giving yourself that early batting average allows you to take chances and gambles on guys that probably won't return good batting averages later, right? I later invest in Jake Berger. I later invest in Dalton Varsho, two guys that might not and probably won't give me great batting averages. But the combination of drafting a guy like Nico Hoerner with a guy like Freddie Freeman means I can take those risks a little bit later because they're going to get a lot of plate appearances with good batting averages to kind of offset the bad batting averages I took later.
Yeah, like Hoerner just makes it more flexible to build a team out of. So even if you think he's slightly overvalued, which I do, not by much, but a little bit, he's just an important linchpin that you can build on. A Kyle Schwarber, I mean, it's easier to take a Kyle Schwarber. Jake Berger, as you mentioned, you can do that kind of build. You couldn't if you didn't have that base of batting average. So I agree with that. Go to Ruvane's team. Ruvane, one thing I noticed about you took several relief pitcher darts at the end. You took Jason Adam. You took Gratterall. You took Giovanni Gallegos. Was the plan to take that many darts? And did you take them in order to get saves, or are you literally intending them to play them as good middle relievers?
Well, I wasn't planning on taking that many, but I was looking at the starters that were there, and I needed pitchers, and I just didn't love the starters, and why should I play or pick a starter that I'm not going to be happy playing with? This is the team that I'm going to have for the entire season, for 6 months. Am I going to have to stare at a starter that I really don't like, or plug in a middle reliever here now and then? Like, I can plug in these middle relievers first week, second week of the season, while the other starters get their feet under them. And yes, I am trying to get a little bit some darts out there. You never know with closers. Giovanni Gallegos, will he end up closing in St. Louis? Is Ryan Helsley going to stay healthy the whole year? I have no idea. Jason Adam, he'll get you some saves in Tampa. So, you know, there are a lot of guys who I picked on purpose, and I wanted them. Like Gratterall, I had Evan Phillips, so I wanted the handcuff. So Gratterall, I had in a league we were in last year in GDD, I had the combination of both of them. And there were times when I was playing both of them at the same time, because why not have two good relievers from one team? You get saves from both of them, you get all the saves from a good team, and you get the good ratio. So it wasn't necessarily a plan going in, but as the draft started playing out, the starting pitchers that I wanted either were taken right before, so I said, you know what, let me bulk up in the middle relievers, and I can bulk up on the ERA and WHIP, and I can pick up any pitchers during the course of the season.
All right, good points there. Back to you, Justin. One more question about your team. One thing I noticed, very little risk. Usually you see teams taking prospects and upside guys. Very much not on your team. You took very safe guys, or at least what we perceive as safe, throughout. Maybe in the end, in the bench rounds, you took a couple of shots, but very low risk. Was that the plan as it is, or are you just a very risk-averse person?
Yeah, so I have a pretty fun reputation as the person who loves to take a lot of injury risk and a lot of risk in general. And that comes from my 2019 main event team, where I took a bunch of guys who were injured, a bunch of kind of high risk, high reward guys, and then lit $1,700 on fire. I learned from that. And while the reputation has kind of stuck with me, it's actually the opposite of what I do. I draft a lot of safe, boring guys. If you go and look at a lot of these teams that have won the main event overall or TGFBI overall, what you'll see is that their teams are awfully boring. But what they do is they just rack up plate appearances. They're very, you know, they don't get injured very often, and they just get these guys who are like a bunch of guys who are getting 650, 700 plate appearances, a lot of pitchers with 150 to 200 innings. And they just kind of volume their way to a championship. And that is my strategy. And so I don't tend to take a lot of risks in terms of my drafting in general. I want to, I'll take risks in FAB. If I think there's a guy that's potentially coming up, or there's a guy that might be a little risky, I might take a gamble in season on them, but I'm not going to do that very often, at least in the first 15 to 20 rounds of a draft. After that, I mean, you're going to be dropping most of your guys after round 15 to round 20. I'll take a little bit more gambles there, but in the meat of your draft, the beginning of your draft especially, I think it's better to stay risk averse, so that way you have a really good base to work from.
Yeah, I agree with that pretty much. And I'll also add that the fact that there's no injured list spots in the NFBC means that you really have to take less injury risk, if any. So, all right, interesting to hear that. I think people take more risks more often than that, and good to hear that that is a plan. All right, before we go on to auctions, one thing that you get from this TGFBI is you get a pretty robust set of ADP, where, you know, you've got 28 leagues, and everybody's drafting, and at the same time, pretty much, I mean, it's a slow draft, but in the same course of action, you get a pretty robust ADP. Wondering if you spotted any trends that you could share to us.
That's a really good question. I honestly hadn't thought too much about it. The hard part with a thing like TGFBI is by the time all the leagues are done, I mean, we start at the end of February, and literally I think the last league finished drafting this last weekend when I was in New York. A lot of the early ADP stuff is kind of useless now, right? Because, you know, injuries have happened and other drafts have gone on. So, I think one of the things you notice in leagues like TGFBI that is filled with a lot of industry guys and also filled a league where people really care about winning the overall, right? Winning your league is great. We all want to win our leagues, but everybody really wants to win the overall is people get a little bit too risky and they take a lot of chances and they compile risk on top of risk, which I think is a poor choice. And you'll see, you know, some, you know, crazy picks inside of the ADP. Like, I think Francisco Alvarez went like top 50 in one of the drafts. And it's like, either that person was trying to get talked about on other podcasts, or they're just trying to be super, super risky and hope to hit. But that's honestly, again, going back to my earlier point, it's like that's not how you win an overall. You win an overall by compiling really, really good stats from kind of safer players. So to me, I think the TGFBI ADP is really interesting to look at, but I don't know if there's a ton to be gleaned from it.
Yeah, it's very similar to the NFBC ADP. And Francisco Alvarez, by the way, that guy took him at 46. The next highest take was at 130. So that was not necessary on that guy's part. Maybe he really wanted him, but he could have waited 80 picks later and had no risk of actually losing him. Yeah, I will say, though, that in general, as compared to previous years, this TGFBI, the range or variance of min to max was lower in general than other years. Like people, there's much tighter range that people were taking. I think people were studying NFBC ADP a lot more and going more chalk than they usually do. That's the one trend that I saw. All right, on to auctions. So as we said at the open, Justin and Ruben and I, we were in a number of auctions together. So the first question, and let me open up to Ruben first. What is the biggest difference for you between a snake draft and the auction format?
Well, in an auction format, you can control your league, basically. You can control your own team. No one says you can't have anybody. Everybody's on the table. And if you see a bargain, you grab it. So that's a big difference. And it gives you more flexibility in how you want to plan for your draft. If planning for an auction, you can have a whole bunch of people in a certain category that are the same price level, and you can say, you know what, these are all guys are interchangeable, and I can take whoever I want. You can't necessarily do that when you're doing it in a snake draft. So I happen to prefer auctions. I love doing the auctions, especially the live auctions. Those are even much more fun than online auctions. But still, even the online auctions, they're fun to see how people play, how people who are bidding, who's going to bid a dollar here, who's going to bid a dollar there, and sometimes having the same people in the league over and over again, like Justin's in our league over and over again, you get to learn tendencies from these people.
Anything to add, Justin?
Yeah, I think one of the main differences for me, and I think Ruben kind of alluded to this, but I'll just expound upon it a little bit further. So when you're drafting a team, you're putting together a puzzle, but when you're doing a snake draft, you have to do it in the order that the, you know, draft is going, right? You've got to put your first piece down and then your second piece, and you can still build it differently than other people, but you have to do it in sequential order. Whereas in an auction, you can put the puzzle together any way you want. And I think this just gives you a lot more opportunities to do fun, interesting, different builds, to kind of play around with how you want to build your team. And it's really the best way to draft. Like, I love doing a snake draft, but for me, an auction is like the purest form of building your team the way you want, and especially the live ones. I mean, doing the live one of Labor, doing the live one, it's outwards. It's just so much fun to do. And I think it's like one of the best experiences you get in fantasy.
Oh, totally agree. And to add to that, I think it also makes it a valuation question. It's deciding, well, is the top 10 players of value? Is it $15 players that are of value? You get to see where values are. And that's more analogous to real life. I mean, general managers don't say, well, I got to sign one good player and one not so good player. No, they can build it any way they want. So why wouldn't we want that experience as well?
Especially if you're the Dodgers.
Dodgers are how many first rounders?
A lot, yeah.
Yeah. All right, next question here. What is it, Justin, what is it like to draft against Ariel Cohen?
It is very, very fun. I think you are just an absolute character in the drafts. And so that in itself is a really fun experience. On the flip side of the coin, it's also very frustrating because you and I think have very similar valuations in terms of players generally, and in terms of how we want to build a team. And so you and I tend to kind of butt heads quite a bit inside of the auction. So I'm really glad that you and I are not drafting against each other anymore this year, because I think I got more than my fair share worth of drafts against you.
Yeah, it's very similar. Justin is extremely fun to draft with. You know, one thing that I'll say, though, is that I think that you livened up the room really well, especially the one that you were sitting next to me. It makes it lively. You know, you have jokes the whole time. I try to make jokes. We had Nick Pollock also on the other side, also fun as well. Gray Albright was in one of ours. He's a very fun guy. This should be fun. So, you know, drafting the experience is fantastic, and drafting with Justin Mason is a great experience. And for the same reasons that you said, that this year especially, a lot of the same players that you value similarly, it just makes it hard, because part of what you're gaining in value in terms of auction is you want to get player bargains. And if other players are in at the same players at similar price points, it's harder to get those values. You might have to go the extra dollar and plan around it. So I do agree with that sentiment.
And we actually did alter our plan a little bit, because we wanted to nominate some players. And we knew that if we nominate this person, if we nominate, especially we were talking about nominating during the draft, nominating TJ Friedel, we knew that it was a good idea that you're probably going to go after him. So or Cedric Mullins, we know you like certain guys. So we actually held back from nominating these guys because we wanted them also. So because we wanted them also, we didn't want them on the board because there was still too much money on the board, and we get into a bidding war with you, and we specifically didn't do that. Did you like Justin? Did you shy away from nominating anyone that you knew that we liked?
I don't think I shied away from nominating anyone you guys liked per se, but I definitely was keeping an eye on where you guys were at with money, because I knew we were going to go head to head on a number of guys. And so I definitely make sure, you know, I'm checking to make sure where everybody's kind of at with money, but you guys specifically, I was very, very in tune with what your money situation was, because I didn't want to get in a situation where I had to pay $18 for a TJ Friedel or someone like that when I could probably get him for, you know, 12 later on. So I am not as much into kind of worrying too much about the exact players other teams are going to go after in an auction, especially the ones that I want to, mostly because I'm going to build my team differently every time. And so while I think a lot of people think like, ooh, if I throw out Cedric Mullins, it happened at Tout Wars, you know, somebody threw out Cedric Mullins and they're all like, why isn't Justin bidding? Well, you know, I did eventually get into the bidding. Yeah, I did eventually get into the bidding, but like, I don't need any particular player to make my team work. What I need is a collection of the right players. And that can change from auction to auction for me.
Yeah, yeah. I would say for me, it knowing what other players' tendencies, it's not about the specific players. It's more about the pockets of value. So, for example, in NL Tout that I proxied for Ian Khan, NL Labor, I should say, that I proxied for him, I knew there was a lot of guys who played middle. We're talking about Derek Hardy, Eric Carabel, Doug Dennis. They play the middle. So I knew that if I just said, all right, I'm just going to play the middle as usual, it wouldn't work. I'd be fighting for too many players. So I purposely, when I'm making my plan and saying, all right, I got to adjust for it, I said, all right, I'm going to get one of those big first basemen. I'm going to get an Olsen, a Harper, a Freeman, and maybe even pay the dollar or two extra, because if I don't get them there, I'm going to have to ridiculously overpay in the middle, right? I got Machado. I knew I was going to have to get Machado or Arenado at third base, because I knew I just can't keep paying over the middle. I got to get enough guys up top to avoid the spot, which I know people in the draft are. If you know that there's a draft that people just go hot and nobody plays the middle, then I don't worry about that. Then I say, let's just play the middle. Don't worry. If there's a good value up top, I'll take it. Otherwise, just sit back and wait. So knowing who's in your draft, I think, really, really helps in terms of an auction. Question for you, Justin. Do you, or how do you, look at market values prior to a draft? You come in with an expectation of, oh, this guy is going to go for a certain price and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, what I'll do is in my draft software or draft sheet, I'll put in what the average auction value, especially if I'm like on an FBC where that's pretty readily available, just to kind of know like, hey, is this a guy that on average I'm probably not going to be able to get because I've got him valued way too low or way too high. So, but for the most part, because every auction's different, every auction, you know, has its own dynamics. I don't worry too much about what the field is going to do or what it's done, especially what it's done in the past, just because I think that there's going to be guys that, you know, in every auction that you go, well, his average auction value is $21 and I'm at, you know, 19, so I'm not going to get him. And then all of a sudden in the auction, the bidding stops at 13 and you need to be able to jump in and go, okay, I'll go 14 on this. So, to me, I don't worry too much about the previous stuff and more focus on what's going on inside of my own auction.
All right. Another question. Do you assume a certain hitter-pitcher split? Like, is that an important thing for you to hammer in?
I go in with a certain hitter-pitcher split, but I'm totally fine adapting to what the auction is giving me. So, I mean, I've seen this a couple times already in auctions this year where, you know, I think it was at Tout Wars, there was a lot of people who were spending on pitching, and I wasn't really super comfortable with the prices. And so I ended up just rolling more money into my offense, and I was fine with that. And I've done the opposite in other auctions. I think in one of my NFBC auctions this year, you know, the prices on pitching wasn't nearly as, as scary or as big as I'm used to seeing in these NFBC auctions. So I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to take advantage of kind of the surplus value on the pitching side. So I think it's okay to come in with a hitter pitcher split. And I usually, you know, it's usually 65-35 for me. But I can, you know, I can kind of go either way on that in terms of, you know, maybe a 70-30 or a 60-40. But for me, I think the most important thing is to just stay kind of flexible, because if the room is hot for one side or the other, then you should kind of pivot to the other side to kind of extract as much value as you can.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'll say two things, though, that I think there's a difference, though, between how much pitching versus how much hitting you're going to buy. And I think you addressed that correctly, that, you know, you come in with an expectation, but if hitter prices are, you know, way too high, you might want to make up the value by buying more pitchers. I agree with that. I will say, though, that optically, when you make your value sheet, when you say, all right, this guy's worth whatever, that I think you need to pre-program to what the market tendencies are. Best you can guess it. In the NFBC, it's close to like 63-37 right now. So I will program my value sheet for exactly that split. And the idea is, even though you might see better stuff or not in the auction, you want to be able to say that a hitter or a pitcher, you want to be indifferent to buying a bargain in each. Like if you had too high a hitter split and you had 70-30 and there was much more pitching, you would think that every hitter is a bargain and you would think that pitchers aren't bargains. But the truth of the matter is it's more what the market says, because you do have to, in the end of the day, it's not a points league in a roto league. You have to buy pitching and you have to buy hitting. So you want to be able to tell yourself psychologically that there are just as many hitter bargains as there are pitcher bargains. So if you don't tilt your market values as such, and you don't tilt your own pricing as such, you're going to be in a hole from there. And obviously, as the draft goes on, you might notice something else happening. It might be, oh, more pitching than not. If you're good at it, you need to sort of tilt some of your values that you have in draft to account for that. So again, it's how much you're going to purchase, but it's also optically what your player values are that you see, so that you are indifferent to getting bargains in either.
But each auction is different, though, because even if you say you're going to go in saying it's 60-40, if you see that the room is hot and all of a sudden all the hitters go extremely expensive, you may want to throw more money into pitching. You have to be flexible. You have to have plan A. You have to have plan B. If you want to move this guy over here, you have an option for an expensive pitcher, an option for an expensive hitter. Because even though we know what the norms are, even though we know what the normal breakdown is, each auction is its own beast. Each auction, you have to plan to have another plan and have another plan and a backup plan and an emergency plan just in case. Oh, you know what? What if, let's say a Ronald Acuna falls on your lap for a very cheap price? If something like that happens, you know, that alters your entire plan for the rest of the draft, because you're spending a whole lot of money on one player that you weren't planning on doing that. So I think it's a matter of, yes, you have to understand the split and know what you want to do for the split, but you still have to be flexible during the course of the auction.
Yeah, no, definitely agree on the flexibility. And, you know, since you mentioned Ronald Acuna, one thing I noticed, Justin, is that it seemed, and tell me if I'm wrong, that you were prepared to buy Ronald Acuna Jr. As long as the price wasn't insane and as long as it was under your values, you seemed to buy him. I mean, you spent $61 on him in Tout Mixed League. You spent, I think, $49 on him in the Labor. And I guess you were prepared to even go in head-to-head, although you were beat out by price. I think Ryan Hallam got him in the end. Was that the plan? Is that, you know, Acuna is worth X, I'm going to get, if it's a $3 bargain, I don't care if it's such a high spend, I'm going to get that bargain. Was that your plan?
I mean, that's my plan for every player, right? It's if I have a guy valued at a certain point and he goes under that point, I'm willing to take a gamble on him. And especially when it's one of the higher priced players, like I'll even go pretty close to value just because you're getting so much bang for your buck. I've regretted a little bit in Tower Wars because 61 was just a huge portion of my budget. It was a lot easier to do in Labor, which was a 12-team league versus the 15-team league in Tower Wars. But ultimately, yeah, just for me, like, I know that, one, in a snake draft, like, you have to get the first pick, right, in order to get Acuna. So, and I don't think I have gotten the first pick, and I won't get the first pick in any draft this year. So I can't get Ronald Acuna in a snake draft. And I know that somebody is going to go insanely high in almost all of my NFBC auctions on Acuna. I mean, he'll go for probably $65 to $70 in both of my $1,500 auctions that are coming up this weekend and next week. So I figured, you know, Tout Wars and Labor are really nice spots to take the gamble. One, because nobody cares about second place, right? There's no prize pool, so like you only get accolades if you win, and I learned that firsthand last year when I lost on the last day of Tout Mixed to Brett Sayre and finished in second place. So for me, and plus there's unlimited IL in those places, so I can take a little bit of that injury risk in those leagues a little bit easier than I can in NFBC, which has no IL, or even in a general like home league, because you know you might have like three IL spots. So the combination of those things made it easier for me to take the gamble. I kind of regret doing it in Tout just because $61 kind of hamstrung me the rest of the way, and I would have liked to have a more balanced team. But in Labor, I loved it. It was really, really fun getting him at $49 and then still being able to have enough money to go get Bobby Witt for like $44 or $45 was pretty fun.
Yeah. I mean, certainly if he's a value according to your own numbers, it's hard to pass up, especially at the top. If you're getting a $3 discount on a top player, it's hard to do that. You sometimes have to pay a dollar over for a high priced player. The only thing I'd say is that if you have such a big spend, which you alluded to, it does hamstring you later, and it also, you know, there are values available later in the draft, and you might have to say, well, I know this guy's $3 bargain later. I have to pass on him because I got Acuna, right? You're passing over some bargains. As long as you think that the bargain is large enough on that player that you won't find that kind of bargain later on, then it's fine. In mixed, obviously, is much easier to do that because there are, you know, you can go to $1 players more easily. The deeper the league it is, $1 players are not as great. You want more $2, $3 players, so on and so forth. So in a mono league, I even though Acuna might be valued at $50, I don't know if I would go more than $42 because I just don't want to be left with $1 and $2 players. So it's not just a value thing. It's about construct of your team, in my opinion.
And I think that is a really, really good point because just because you're getting, you know, good value, especially good value on a high-priced player, doesn't mean you should do it. Because like for me, like in Tout Wars, right, I spent $61. I think I had value. It's like a $63 player. That's great. I got $2 of value on the best player in fantasy, but there were guys who went later who were by my projections, like over $10 of value under their price. So, I probably would have profited more,
right,
if I had gone for a different guy at the top of my roster, saved that, you know, $20 or $30 and spread it around to a bunch of guys that I could have gotten $5 of profit or $6 of profit or $10 of profit. So, and this is, you know, kind of what I did last year in Tout Wars, where I didn't buy a player for the first hour and a half, right? Like every early guy for the first hour and a half was overpriced by my calculations. And what I did was I just cleaned up the middle and walked out of there with, you know, a team that I didn't have a player cheaper than like $6 or $7. And I had all my guys as projected value. So like I walked out of there with a ton of kind of added value. And I kind of wish I had done that this year. You know, and I probably should have stopped when the bidding got to 60. I shouldn't have gone above that. I should have just probably pivoted to something else.
Yeah, and even the point about passing on a guy, even though he's profitable, like, for example, in our head-to-head points league that we just did, one of my, I don't know, say it's regret, is Anthony Santander. And I had him valued at, like, say, let's say $13, and I got him for $10, which seemingly is, oh, okay, a $3 bargain. That sounds great. But I realized shortly after that, oh, you know what? There were better bargains if I waited. I could have gotten, you know, a $10 guy for $4, you know, and made a bigger bargain. And the question is, did I get the biggest bargain I can on that roster spot? And that's always that's the question you got to ask yourself. When you take a guy in an auction, it's not just, I got a player. It's, did I utilize that spot and get the most bargain out of that slot? And if the answer is yes, great. If the answer is no, then you probably should have waited a little bit more. Anything to add, Mouvin?
Yeah, and a follow-up question for Justin. If Acuna was going for, let's say the draft you had, the auction you had was online, and they went to 60 online, would you have gone to 61, or you think it was, you know, having a live auction, do you think that impacted you going to 61?
I think it did. I'll be honest, like, you know, and I think that that is the difference between a live auction and an online auction. Is an online auction, you don't really get emotionally invested in the same way. Because you see the reactions of everybody, and people are, I mean, especially when you're in an auction full of friends, right? Like when we're talking about the Cedric Mullins bidding, like there were people egging me on to get involved, and I did get involved. But like there were people who were like, they're trying to get you to spend money, and they're cheering you, and they, especially when it's a bunch of your buddies. So like, I think had that been online, I would have probably walked away at 59 and just let whoever
peer
was going
pressure
up against me have him. Yeah, it totally plays a part in it.
Right. No, absolutely. It is very different online versus live. As I said before in the show, you know, online is, I think, tougher for one person because you're constantly looking at your own values on your screen. Then you got to look at the actual auction going on another screen and go back and forth. Live, you're hearing it. Right, you're hearing the bids. You're shouting out the bids. It's much easier to actually, you're just looking at one thing on your computer screen, your own values, and you hear everything. You can multitask more. Live, I think, is a much better venue in general. Going to the labor, Justin and I were in Florida a couple weeks ago in the mixed labor. Now, one thing to note, this was a 12-team, not a 15-team. So, Justin, let's just set this up. What are some of the differences in terms of strategy and gameplay when you're going from the NFBC style 15-team to the labor, which is a 12-team style? And plus, labor also has IL spots, whereas the NFBC does not.
Yeah, so for me, it allows me to be more aggressive. And again, so like, not only did I get Acuna in the labor draft, I also was able to then get Bobby Witt Jr. and kind of do a stars and scrubs approach, which is not something you will really ever see me doing in a 15-team league. Especially when you add in the fact, like you said, like labor has unlimited IL, whereas like NFBC has zero IL. This allows you to be more risky and take gambles on guys that you wouldn't necessarily gamble on in the NFBC realm, or even in your home league where like you might have like three IL spots. So for me, it allowed me to be aggressive, kind of especially on those top guys, and kind of go the extra dollar in a way that I wouldn't, because I know that there's going to be a ton of replacement value on the wire that isn't available in your traditional 15-team leagues. So I definitely went a lot more stars and scrubs-ish on my labor team in a way that would normally make me feel uncomfortable, but I really like the end result.
Yeah, and to recap a little bit of what you did, you grabbed Acuna for 49, you got Witt for 42, Vlad for 28, so it was stars and scrubs hitting. The pitching, though, not as much. Your top-valued pitchers, you got $18 Eflin, $18 Scooble, which is actually pretty good pricing, and you got a $9 Tanner Bibee, and then you took low darts, and interestingly, all the darts that you took were either a $1, $2, or in the reserve rounds, you got Scherzer, you got Paxton, John Means, and you got a $2 Kyle Bradish in the auction. So you went low pricing on the pitching in general, but with a lot of upside darts, and you did the stars and scrubs. And I guess you're telling me that that is very different than what you do in 15-team because of literally the format.
Yeah, and also because of just, I mean, most of my 15-team leagues are on NFBC, and almost everybody you're going to run into in an NFBC auction is doing a Stars and Scrubs. They're going to overpay for those top talents. And to me, what I found is the easiest way to be successful in these NFBC leagues is kind of spreading the risk around, right? Especially in the 15-team leagues where there isn't as much on the waiver wire to replace when guys go down. And so, like, if I'm going to, like, load up my team with a bunch of players who, like, especially pitchers who are, like, under $20, like, if I lose one to Tommy John, if one turns into Alek Manoah and is just trash, like, it doesn't hurt as much to drop that guy as it does to lose a $35 pitcher, you know, or much less a 40-something dollar pitcher like Gerrit Cole was coming into some of these early NFBC auctions. So to me, like, I, especially with my pitching staff, I tend to feel a lot better about kind of playing the middle and kind of volume my way into, you know, success with a balanced approach.
Now, Ariel, I like what you did in your outfield. You got Luis Schwarber for 24, Nolan Jones for 20, Schwarber for 19, a couple others for 10. But what really struck me was you spent $27 on catching. You spent the most in the league on catching. Why was that?
Yeah, interesting. Well, two reasons. Well, first of all, I did intend to get at least one high-priced catcher because I thought, going in, I thought that there would be some good bargains even at the top. I got William Contreras for 17, which I thought was a nice bargain. There was a couple of $1, $2 catchers that were good bargains, but I knew going in that I would be spending less on some of my infielders, the corners and the middles than usual. And I knew that in order for me to get more money, to put more money into offense rather than pitching, I thought the best way would be to get it done during catching. So that was the William Contreras. The Francisco Alvarez one was a little bit of a semi-bluff. It was early on. Somebody else nominated him. I like Francisco Alvarez, and so I thought he would go much higher, and I went to 10. Nobody else went higher. So I took Francisco Alvarez, which I thought was a bargain. I intended it to be just, you know, a $17 Contreras and then, you know, nobody else. So I got stuck with having him also. Again, I like the value. I didn't intend to get two high-priced catchers, but I'm okay with it because I spent a lot on pitching during this draft. So just so I can get more money into the offense, catcher was a fine place to get it.
Because I remember I texted you when that happened. I'm like, wait a second. We never do that. We never spend money on two catchers. Sometimes one, but never two. I'm like, wait a second. Maybe he bought him because it was a Met. I mean, if you want to throw more money into the offense and you don't want to overspend, I guess catching is probably the best place to get some more value. But, you know, it's very rare to see someone spending that much money on catchers.
Yeah. I mean, my whole infield was cheap. I got like a $3 Bohm, Tovar for $3. McMahon for $3, Ke'Bryan Hayes a cheap $6. So I just didn't have a lot of money on the offensive side. So that was one way to put him in the catching. And by, you know, bargains are bargains anywhere. So if the bargains came up in catching, that's great.
And what's gonna be your plan now? Because in pitching, you also drafted and you got Devin Williams. What's gonna be your plan now? Now you know that Devin Williams is gonna be out for a while. Do you have a plan of how you're going to manage that? I mean, are you going to go hard on the waiver wire? Are you going to wait? Are you going to take some darts on the waiver wire? What are you going to do with that?
Yeah, oh dear. Devin Williams, I thought it was an amazing buy at $16 where you had other, you know, Diaz going for 20-something. It's too bad that he was the guy. Well, you know, it is a 12-team league, thank goodness, instead of a 15. There are, first of all, I can fab the Milwaukee replacements. I can do that. I can also go cheapo and go for some Colorado situation or Oakland or something like that. But, you know, because it is 12-team league, there are more saves available in fab during the year. I just have to be a little bit more on the trigger for fab to get that. If this was a 15-team league, it would be a lot worse, of course.
Or you can come to your neighborhood Justin Mason store and ask him to trade you one of his three closers.
That's true. You know, I was going to ask you, Justin, one thing I've noticed, you did this. You also did this in an online auction that we played against each other. You bought three closers, and that was even in a 15-team league. Was that your plan?
I always like to get kind of two locked-in guys and then kind of take a gamble on a third. You never know what's going to happen if your quote unquote locked in guy is going to get hurt or lose his job, because closers lose their jobs, usually about 40% of them per year. I know last year was a really great year for closers, but it's already, like, since we left New York, like, it's already just gone to hell. Handbasket in terms of a lot of closing situations because of injuries. So I love to kind of speculate on a third guy, and often, like, in the reserve rounds of auctions or drafts, like, I'm just wildly throwing darts, hoping to get lucky, because especially in trade leagues, because it gives you this asset that is hard to find on the wire, especially hard to find elite ones on the wire, as a tradable asset. So, like, you know, now I can go to you, or I can go to the guy who may have just lost, like Jordan Romano or Duran, and go, hey, listen, you interested in a little Alex Lang? Are you interested in a like a Class A or a Hader, and kind of try to, like, you know, patch other holes that maybe I have, or you know, add a strength on top of strength.
Yeah, that's true. In a trading league, value is value, and it's okay if you overaccumulate something because you can trade it to get more value. That is a good point, and that is a difference between an NFBC where you need to be more spread from the get-go, as opposed to one of these trading leagues that, if I got too many steals, no problem. You can trade it away. There's somebody willing and needing some of the other categories.
There's actually something to be said, and like Derek Van Riper a few years ago won the mixed auction in Tout Wars, in large part because he just spent all of his money on offense. And he went, listen, I'm not going to worry about pitching injuries, because what I'm going to do is, after I build up a league in my hitting categories, I'm going to start trading all my elite hitters for elite pitchers, and then I'm just going to run away with this league. And that's what he did. Like, he, you know, halfway through the season, he just started trading all of his elite hitters for pitchers, and he just ended up dominating us. So, like, I know that kind of our natural instinct in trading leagues is to continue to stay balanced, and I think you should, because you don't want to have to rely upon getting a trade worked out, because you never know if some people are just going to be like, I'm not going to trade with you. But I think it's a really good way of, like, maximizing your value if you're seeing, especially, like, you know, hitters go for a little bit too cheap. You know, make the trades later and kind of figure all that stuff out later.
Yeah, that is true. And of course, you know, if you have a league that just doesn't trade a lot, or, you know, especially right after the draft, you know, you bought a guy for 16, it's because you think he's a $16 player. You know, it's harder to trade if people are really close to their values. But yes, that is a good point. There is many ways to utilize the trading market to your advantage. You also played this weekend in Tout Mixed. I was in the room watching you do it. Any points or any information to gather from that league?
It was a really fun league, filled with a lot of really good personalities. It's really interesting because, you know, the Tout Mixed auction has been very kind of filled with the same guys year after year. And this year, all of a sudden, there were six new faces that hadn't been drafting in this league before. Either they were new to Tout generally, or they'd moved over from different leagues. So we kind of got kind of an influx of different personalities and different strategies, which definitely, I think, threw the room for a loop. I think one of the things that, you know, like, when you're drafting against people, you may not know what their tendencies are because you haven't drafted against them before, is to kind of just stay ready. I think there was an opportunity for, like on Corbin Carroll, who was one of the early players starting out, where, like,
yeah,
the bidding stopped
that.
At, like, yeah, bidding stopped at like $37, and like everybody kind of froze. And I really wish I had jumped in there. I knew I already had an
expensive everybody opinion. Wished they jumped in more.
Yeah, because like the next player that went out was like Mookie Betts, and I think he went for like $47. And like people are like, how did Mookie just go for so much when Corbin Carroll just went for so little? So I think just making sure that, like, when you're in an auction with people that you may not know their tendencies, that you, like, you just stay fluid and ready for anything that might happen. Because I think often we let players sneak by because we're just unprepared for what we're seeing.
And Justin, you were actually drafting as a proxy. Did that change at all how you were drafting? Did you speak to the person you were drafting for before you went in and you had a plan all set out with him? Or was it just, you know, fly by the seat of your pants?
So that was in the head-to-head points league, and that was for Michael Govier. He did not give me any sort of requirements. I asked him prior to the auction, like, hey, Who do you want, or is there anybody you really want, or more importantly, is there anybody you really don't want? And he was like, I trust you, which is kind of like, I'd rather you at least give me a checklist of people to avoid, so you don't, like, look at your team and go, oh, man, I hate this team. So for me, I mean, I wanted to get him, you know, players that I felt were kind of undervalued in the format, but I also... I put a lot of injured players on the roster because it has unlimited IL. It's a 12-team league. And I was like, hey, at least he can backfill these spots with guys that he likes, right? Like, I don't know if he's going to want that $7 Garrett Cole, but, you know, hey, at least he can replace him with someone off the waiver wire that maybe he does like, since there's going to be a lot of replacement value in a 12-team league.
And Ariel, you drafted as a proxy also in one of the leagues. How did that affect you?
So very different in terms of setup. I was for NL Labor. I drafted for Ian Khan. And unlike Govier, who just said go draft, I spent a lot of time talking with Ian on who he likes, on looking at the values. I mean, it was a joint effort. I mean, I showed what my values were for the players, and, you know, he tweaked them. All right, this one, let's go a little bit more. This one, nah, let's go a little bit less. And so going in, I had a certain set of values that was, you know, jointly made, and I was able to draft to that. I used the same powers of economics that I used for running an auction. That was all Ariel Cohn at the table, and the nominating style and everything. But in terms of the values, it was, you know, I'm using what the owner of the team really wanted. I will say it's a lot of fun drafting as a proxy, especially in that regard. Because if you win, you say, look what a great job I did. If you lose, well, I guess your values stunk. So.
Yeah, I was able to make the joke quite often, like, I don't care, it's not my team, like,
right? No, it was great. I mean, you had two Tout Wars drafts, I had two Labor drafts. I gotta say, it's really fun in a weekend, back-to-back days. Draining, yes, but really fun drafting. I'm sure you really enjoyed that experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I love those live auctions, and especially the Tout Wars weekend. Both of those rooms were really, really fun. It's just a really good group of men and women in these Tout Wars drafts. And Labor, same as well, right? Like, because I got, like, Labor, you know, obviously you're in the room, but we also have, you know, Shelley Verstraete and Gray Albright and Nick Pollock. And, like, it's just a really, really fun room to draft in. These ones, and so getting to do two in New York and Tout Wars, I'm sure my wife would have been much happier had I only done one, so that way I could have spent Sunday with her, but I just had an absolute blast drafting with everybody.
Totally. And your wife came to watch some of it also. We saw her there.
Yeah, she likes to come in and heckle me a little bit and then disappear off to, you know, doing fun things in New York.
Absolutely. Before, just talk a little bit about our teams. One thing, though, is that we mentioned hitter-pitcher split before in Roto, because you have to have, there's, you know, the same number of categories for hitters, same number of categories for pitchers. Here it's points. So technically you don't have to really follow a hitter-pitcher split. Were you conscious of that at all?
Yeah, so I was, my first year in Tout Wars, I was in this league, right? And actually the first time I ever drafted in Tout Wars, I wasn't even in Tout Wars. I stood in for Stefania Bell, cause she got sick the night before the draft. It had a much more hitter focus the first year, and then they changed the point system, but they made a mistake in the way they set it up, where it became like a much, like, bigger pitcher focus. When you're doing a points league, I think the one thing people don't do often enough is run your favorite projection system, which probably should be ATC, right? through some sort of software, and let the software determine what the point value is, or the dollar value is, for that point system. And when I did that in, I think it was 2018 for the Tout Wars points league, when they messed up on the point structure, like, it made every pitcher worth more than every hitter by a long shot. And so, like,
oh dear,
everybody went into that draft outside of me with, like, a 60-40 hitter pitcher split, when everybody should have done what I did, which was spend $200 on pitching. And so this is why it's so important to run your favorite projection system, ATC probably, through some sort of software and kind of see where it lands. They've done a better job of fixing the point system for Tout Wars. And so I think it is probably best served as a 60-40 hitter pitcher split. But you can kind of do what you want with that. Like, I don't think they're like, I think Nick Pollock didn't spend very much on his pitching at all, because he's like, I know pitching and I can stream my way through the pitching in the season. And I think you just kind of built your strength, and kind of, if you're better at finding hitters on the wire, then, spend more on pitching. If you're better at finding pitchers on the wire, then spend more on hitting and kind of build your team whichever way you want.
Yeah, I went the other way with Nick. I actually spent only 50% of my money on hitting. And I wasn't intending to do that far split. But I thought that the pitching prices were a lot more reasonable than the hitting, and I knew that I can get really good bargains on hitting all the way up and down. That was sort of the plan. So I bought I bought four $18 plus pitchers, which is a lot. And I also got a $10 Mitch Keller. So I really spent a lot. I also bought two high valued relievers. I bought Class A and Camilo Duval. So I just said, all right, you know what? I think the value is in the pitching. And it's not like it's a roto league, right? It's just pure points. You don't have to have a certain number of hitters or pitching. That's sort of the way it fell for me. Because of that, I might get a little bit more volatile results because, of course, you know, pitching, you can have a good start, a bad start for a pitcher. So my results week to week could be more volatile, but I should end up with a lot of points because if I did this correctly. One thing I do want to ask, Justin, you kept nominating catchers, and I don't know if that was because I kept nominating catchers and you were the guy right after me. Was that the reason? Like, what was going on with your catcher nominations?
So in that league, I anticipated getting some kind of expensive catchers early on, and I did get Rutschman, but like, I felt like a lot of the other catcher values were going for over what I had kind of valued. And so I was like, in a 12 team league, even a 12 team two catcher league, like the last catcher off the board is still going to be fairly decent, especially comparatively speaking to like an only league or even a 15 team mix. Like, the catcher depth this year is really, really good. And so I just kind of kept nominating catchers. I saw you were doing it. I was like, I'm going to kind of keep this going because eventually I'm just going to get a pretty decent $1 catcher.
Thank you, by the way. That was, you sort of exacerbated the strategy that I was going for. Every time you nominated him, I was like, yes, good job, Justin. Keep doing that.
And Justin, you ended up spending a lot of money on catchers, too. I think you spent a total of $37 on catchers.
No, but the Salvador, you got a very good deal on Salvador Perez for
$9. Yeah, so and it would have been a much better deal if Ariel hadn't kept bidding me up, even though he didn't need a catcher, because he's just like, I don't want Justin to get this good of a value.
No, but also, Salvador Perez, remember, he also qualifies at first, and even though he was, I don't know, maybe a $19 catcher according to my values, okay, that's as a catcher. As a first baseman, even if you subtract $5, a $9 Salvador Perez as a first baseman is still a good value. So I said, all right, Let's just keep doing it. I'm the one who nominated Salvador Perez. I did that because I already had two catchers. So I didn't need a catcher. I'm happy to take Perez as a first baseman. So that was the crux of this. So I got you up to $9. I wasn't going to go any more. Otherwise, that would have been silly for me.
But Ariel, look at your corner infielders. You have Alec Boehm, Ryan McMahon, and Josh Bell all for $4 or less. You could have used the Salvador Perez at first base.
Yeah, I would have taken an $8 Salvador Perez at first. That would have been amazing. I guess I could have gone to 10 for him, sure. Listen, again, it's about, you know, do I think I'm going to get a bigger bargain on that $10 spend, or am I going to get a bigger bargain by only spending $3 on Josh Bell? So, you know, I played that game, and my limit was 8 for Salvador Perez at that time.
Yeah, I was pretty stoked. Like when Todd was counting off the final, you know, going once, going twice, sold. I was actually really surprised no one jumped in, because I felt like $9. I think I had Salvador Perez like as a $16 player, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, I got the best catcher in the game in Rutschman, and then I got Sal Perez as my a number two, $6 under my value for him. Like, I felt really, really good about that.
Yeah. The best catcher value was to J.B. Brandsen, who got Wilson Contreras for $4. And when that came up, and he went out really, really late. Which, by the way, nominating one of those catchers, I was hoping to avoid somebody getting a big catcher value by doing that. But $4 for him, that is, I wish I had that one. Oh, boy.
Yeah, unfortunately, at that point, like, even my DH was filled, and, like, there's nothing I could do.
Yeah. And you know, you're going to miss out on some bargains. You have to understand that there's going to be – you can't get every player bargain there is. You know, you have to let them go. There's going to be very good bargains out there, some better than you have. You just try to estimate the right point in the draft to say, okay, that's a good bargain. Not going to see more. I bought Jazz Chisholm for $10. I never pictured ever buying Jazz Chisholm. I've always said he's overvalued. But $10, you go with what you're taking, you know? And that's how auctions are made.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Any other points to make from the head-to-head? I think that head-to-head is an undervalued format that our industry covers. It really is one of the most played, maybe the most played format in the for most people out there. My son just literally started in his school. They invite him to a league. It's a head-to-head points format. So I think that more should be done in our industry, and I'm glad that I'm in it to help cover it. But any other points, guys, on head-to-head points?
Yeah, I think the head-to-head points is actually gaining in popularity. My son's actually doing a head-to-head. He's in two head-to-head leagues. And I have a family league that we just have like maybe 6 or 8 people total, but we do head-to-head there also. I like the head-to-head, but I don't like the fact that you can have a great season, you can finish in first place, you can have everything. This has happened to me many times in head-to-head, and you lose in the first round just because your team goes cold. It happened to us in NFBC, not in the head-to-head, but in NFBC, we were in third place, second place, and all of a sudden our team went cold and we ended up falling out of the money. So I mean, it can happen in any league, but it seems to happen more so in head-to-head, and it's just very hard to take that loss.
I do have one question though for you, Justin, because I saw that, you know, you did take Cole, you also took a stab at DeGrom, you got Devin Williams. The head-to-head points league is a playoff format, so once you make the playoffs, the last month of the season is there. That might factor in. Like, for example, if you have a guy like Nate Lowe is going to be injured for the first month or whatever, but when he comes back, he's going to come back and you'll have his full value for the playoffs. Did you take that into account with those picks or in general? Like, was that a plan? I know for me, when I did my evaluations, anybody who's going to be for sure injured just in the first 2 months but come back, I just booked the plate appearances to full playing time to give them the proper treatment for their services.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something I factored in because, you know, like you said, like, you know, a guy like TJ Friedel, for instance, who's going to miss probably the first 2 months of the season, like, yeah, in a traditional league, you may not want to draft him at all, or if you do, you're gonna put a very low amount on him. But, like, if he comes back and he's TJ Friedel from last year, and you're getting him for the final few months of the season, like, that could be a difference maker for you in the playoffs. I think you want to be really careful about loading up too many guys like that, because you just, you know, you don't want to get buried in your standings before you get to the playoffs, because you just may not be a playoff team in that regard. But I think it's really smart, especially if you can, you know, roster elite cheap guys and you have enough IL spots, to kind of load up enough on that. So that way it's almost like a midseason trade for nothing, right? Like, you automatically halfway through the season get these elite players back. If, you know, Govier is in playoff contention and he gets Garrett Cole back, he gets Jacob DeGrom back, and he gets Devin Williams back, well, now he just potentially got two of the three best starting pitchers in baseball and the best closer in baseball on his team for a playoff push and then for the actual playoffs. So, you know, I'm really hoping it works out for him. It was a strategy that I knew if I was in the league that I would try to employ, especially with it being a 12-team league and there being that replacement value to kind of carry him through to until that point. So I really hope he goes out there and wins a tout league this year.
Yeah, no, there you go. I bought Altuve for $8 last year when he was injured. Mm-hmm. I mean, the no-brainer.
Yeah, I got Altuve for $5 in my NFBC auction because nobody wanted to bid on him. And that was probably 5 of the best dollars I spent all year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the playoff format does matter.
And that's the whole thing. This is a long season. You don't win. You can't. You can technically you can lose it in the very beginning of the year, but you can't. But you can't win it in the beginning of the year. You have to have. You have to be able to last. You have to. It's really a triumph of survival to win it all. Actually.
All right. So I think that wraps it up. We've really given a lot of strategy elements for everybody, and also did reviews of our teams along the way. So I hope this is helpful for everyone. Want to thank Justin Mason for coming on the show. Justin, why don't you just tell everybody where we can see your stuff, reach you, and all things Justin Mason.
Yeah, you can find me on pretty much any social media platform, Justin Mason FWFB. I'm mostly on YouTube and Twitter, but I do have all of them at this point. And then you can read all my work on Fangraphs or Fantasy Pros. You can hear me on the Sleeper on the Bus podcast and the Friends Fantasy Benefits podcast. And if you like watching drafts, I'm going to be doing a ton of live stream drafts here over the next, week. So I think I've got an NFBC $150 auction tomorrow night, being Friday night, the 22nd. I have my main event on Saturday, the 23rd, I have a $1,500 auction on NFBC on the 24th and the 27th. I have to beat Justin Mason OC, which is a 12-team NFBC league Monday night. So if you like watching live stream drafts, I'm going to be doing a bunch of them. You can find the link for all of those, including the draft boards on Fangraphs. So we'll be posting articles with everything attached.
I know, great stuff always from Justin, and good luck to you in those. Ruben, what about you?
You can follow me on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, at MLB Injury Guru, where I'm tweeting out injury updates as they come, and they're coming fast and furious now, as well as the people who are going to be coming up right after them, taking their spot. You can also catch my weekly article in season, which is going to be beginning in about a week or so, on Roto Bowler, discussing the injuries and everyone who's not listed in your normal area to find these guys.
All right, I'm Ariel Cohen. You can find me on Twitter at ATCNY. If you want to follow the ATC Projections, I tell you when I post updates, ATC Projections on Twitter/X. I write for Fangraphs, Rotographs, and Roto Baller, and the ATC Projections are up on multiple sites, including those, plus Roto Wire, as well as CBS Sportsline. So check all those out. Download them multiple times a day. I'm just kidding on that. I wish everybody good luck in their draft season. Hope you all found us at the Beat the Shift pod to be really helpful in preparing. And, you know, if there's anything else you'd like us to cover in the future, of course, let us know. Reach out to us. Otherwise, good luck, everyone, in the rest of your draft season. Thanks again to Justin Mason for joining us as a guest on our show today. And from all of us here at Beat the Shift, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Beat the Shift podcast presented by Fangraphs. Follow us on Twitter at beat_shift_pod.